then if there's no way to do that, you've got exigent circumstances in effect. You've got to either act now or this kid's going to be in danger. Looking again at the next subparagraph at lines 18 and 19, the child's going to pose an imminent danger. It's not just a danger, and it's not just an imminent problem. It's an imminent danger to somebody else if that child is not taken into custody right away, and there's just no time to get the order. Just like the order under sub C is also based on a certain degree of exigency, because it's an order issued prior. The court is issuing the order ex parte without having a hearing because, and again I quote this language on lines 1 and 2, that the child will pose the imminent danger to others, in this case, if not taken into custody prior to an adjudicatory hearing. So each step seems to depend on some exigency of the circumstances, mm-hmm. and how imminent that danger is mm-hmm. determines whether you can take immediate action or somewhat delayed action, or whether you can't take action until you've had a full hearing.
Question, Mr.
Representative Bauman.
Are you willing to be available after you've examined this one? And let me ask you to examine this.
All right.
With these questions in mind, because we're concerned, there's a clear statement. I think I've put a clear statement of legislative intent on the record as far as the bill is concerned. And I'm happy to be available. I don't want to spend the committee's time restating that. And I'm happy to meet with you, and you can let the full committee know. What I'd like to do now for the committee is to move the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3198.
Representative Bauman moves the dash 2 amendments. Are you done with Mr. Gruber? We better let him go back to work. I think he's pretty busy. Before I do that, did you have any further inquiries or of the committee to help you get some direction
on this particular bill? I just want to point out, I was answering those questions based on the bill itself and not on what these amendments may do. I'll look at them together.
Please consider them all together.
Right. The dash 2 amendments, right?
Correct.
Just to make sure I have in mind exactly what you want, Representative Bauman, I may. You want to know if the standards are the same, excluding the issue of exigency, the degree of emergency. But other than that, if the standards are the same, is that your question?
I guess the question, it's more of a request that you examine the language that's found on lines 18 through 22 regarding obtaining the court order. And you have a copy of the fiscal analysis. I don't know if the assumptions are available to you or if the committee can get a hold of those assumptions.
I just called. They're bringing them up now.
I'd just like to see an evaluation of the proposed bill compared with the assumptions so that we can look at this, look at the language that we're passing in view of our legislative intent and make sure we're doing what it is we want to do. Is that a...
I'm not sure what you mean by these assumptions, but...
Let me follow up. We have a fiscal impact statement you should get your hands on. You got it. You should get your hands on the attachment and a letter from Children's Services Division dated April 7th, 1987, particular on page 2 of that letter where the words appear that 3198 is interpreted as directing law enforcement and CSD people to consider and seek court orders in all cases prior to an emergency custody action. We want your opinion as to whether or not that is a reasonable interpretation. I think the sense I get of the committee is that that wasn't the intent, nor is that a reasonable interpretation in at least one or more of the committee members' minds. We're interested in the fiscal implications based on that interpretation.
All right, I obviously can't speak to the fiscal interpretation, but I can speak to those assumptions.
And the fiscal will state the assumptions that they made in giving that fiscal statement. They apparently didn't give us any attachments, just the fiscal.
All right, I have here the letter to you.
April 7th.
The April 7th letter, and you say there's some other documents. If the judiciary staff could copy those for me.
We'll make sure you get them.
All right.
Representative Bauman moves the -2 amendments as amendment to the printed bill, House Bill 3198, and I'll place that motion. Is there objection to the -2 amendments? Hearing none. So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
And to her. Representative Bauman.
I'd like to move House Bill 3198 as amended to the full committee with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Bauman moves 3198 to the full committee with the due pass recommendation. And I'll place that motion. Is there further discussion? I have a bit further discussion just to say there's a caveat, and we need to keep ourselves up to date with Mr. Gruber on the concerns that have been raised on the bill, but that it's I'm going to support the motion, move it on to the main committee, and in the meantime we'll get all of the information necessary. We got the fiscal delivered without the attachments of 2 minutes before hearing, and sometimes it's frustrating in this process, but I intend on supporting that to full committee, and if this passes, Representative Bauman, you'll be the carrier and you'll be in charge of keeping us and the full committee up to date on what's occurred with Mr. Gruber and the fiscal in the meantime.
That's a reasonable request.
Any further comments? Okay. Will you call the roll?
Bauman?
Aye.
Delaney?
Aye.
Dix?
Aye.
Bauman?
Aye. The motion is adopted, and Representative Bauman will be delegated the responsibilities to full committee. We have House Bill 3197 for the last bill up today. I'm going to ask, it's 10 after 3, committee members we'll take a 15-minute break, and let me ask you to get back here at 25 after 3 so that we can deal with the last bill on our work schedule, and we'll be in recess for 15 minutes.
The last bill being 97?
3197. In the public hearing on House Bill 3307, Professor Graham is here to testify in that area. If you would come forward, and we've already had some testimony, and we'll be having a further public hearing. We appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to run between Willamette and the state capitol.
Oh, I'm happy to. I had a few concerns about the bill, and I guess should I just go ahead and state those?
We're interested in your testimony on this bill, in particular on what knowledge you can provide us in the technical area on the subject matter and on the bill as printed, and I'll let you swing freely on how you see fit. If you would, introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Kathy Graham, and I teach at Willamette University College of Law. I have read the bill just briefly here, but some of my concerns about surrogate motherhood and about enacting a statute like this include the following. To my way of thinking, the surrogate arrangement in some senses resembles an adoption kind of arrangement, in that in the surrogate arrangement you are, at the time of birth of the child, surrendering your rights as surrogate mother or as natural mother to the child and allowing the the wife of the father to adopt the child as agreed per the contract. And in adoption law in Oregon today, the natural mother may actually choose to change her mind about giving up or surrendering her right to the child up until the time that the adoption decree is finalized and the entry of the adoption decree is becomes effective pursuant to court order. I guess my concern about surrogate motherhood would be that there ought to be some means of protecting her interest in making a choice about whether or not to surrender the child up to and after the birth of the child. And I'm not sure the statute does that, and certainly in the Baby M case in New Jersey, that kind of protection was not accorded to the mother. That's one of the concerns that I have. Another concern, I noticed that in this bill, the proposal, House Bill 3307, would allow for specific performance of the surrogate mother contract. One concern that I would have concerns the right of the mother to abort the child or abort the fetus up to at least the third month of her pregnancy, and I think she has a constitutional right to make that choice for herself, and I'm not sure that the bill could in any way abrogate or a law could abrogate that right that she should have to make that choice for herself.
Professor, can you tell us what the status of this kind of arrangement or agreement is within the state borders of this state at the present time? We had testimony earlier that the going price is around $12,000 for a mother to participate and follow through in one of these contracts.
I don't know.
That isn't what I was asking. I'm asking for the current. I mean, apparently, this occurs in Oregon, and my question of you is, what is its legal status?
My understanding would be that there currently is no law in Oregon that would either prohibit or allow such an arrangement to be made among three parties, I guess the surrogate mother and the husband and wife of the natural father. However, there have been cases in Oregon within the last 20 or 30 years that suggest that any agreement to purchase a baby is illegal, and that would be one of my concerns. I have a law review article that was written in the Willamette Law Journal within the last 6 or 7 years that suggests that there is some thinking in the case law that that kind of an arrangement whereby you're buying a baby would be considered illegal.
The question on that, though, and I think it was Senate Bill 137 from the 1985 session, the question on that is, where does one draw the line when you have payment from the proposed adoptive parents for the hospital expense of the natural mother, or for lawyers' fees, or for those people involved in actually physically making sure the baby gets from the hospital? Perhaps they even are could be a nurse who would come from Oregon and go to Nebraska and bring the baby back on the plane, reimbursement for expense. The question is that where you draw the line becomes awfully difficult as to what is
baby
purchasing,
right,
versus what is acceptable under the law.
I agree. However, it seems to me you could allocate certain kinds of expenses and payment for expenses that would include medical and travel expenses, but once you're beyond that, it seems to me at least there's a question as to the legality of
agreement. I think it's at least spoken to in the Oregon statute, maybe not with the specificity you just mentioned, but that area was acted on last session by this legislature.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bellamy.
I'm interested in a comment that you made, that to allowing the mother to basically change her mind up until the time the baby is born. Why should a person be able to allow if they sign a contract? I guess to me the real issue is whether you allow the contract to be ever signed. But once you sign a contract, why should they be given the right to change their mind?
Well, you've got the issue concerning the contract law, but then you've also got the natural mother and her ties with that child that she's giving birth to, which I think may be a completely different issue altogether than the contract arrangement that she has made with the natural father. In the few cases that there are that concern this issue, courts look not only to the question of the contract, but also to the best interests of the child and to that natural tie that binds the mother with that child that she's given birth to. You know, to me, it's a different kind of situation than the typical kind of contract relationship that's an arm's length agreement.
I guess why should it be? If I knowingly sign a contract, I can't back out of the contract.
Well, let's say, you know, I was thinking about this, and I've got at least one example of a situation which I think perhaps the mother should have a right to back out. Let's say you have a situation in which she makes an agreement with someone, doesn't know the natural father very well, and upon birth of the child, or at least sometime later after signing the contract, she learns that that father's a drug addict. Or she learns that that father is someone that she doesn't believe really should have custody of her child that she's going to be giving birth to. In my mind, she ought not to be required to perform under the terms of the contract in a situation like that. And in my mind, the best interest of the child should play a role in any court determination as to who should have custody of the child after the birth of the child.
Well, then you're indicating that you would, there should be some language in there that would talk to not providing correct information and so forth.
But full disclosure at the time that the contract's entered into?
That's exactly right, because I'll turn it right back around and say, we spend enough time down here protecting people from the buyer beware.
Uh-huh.
If you're signing a contract and you're offering a service, you shouldn't have the excuse later on to say, well, gee, I found out the individual isn't the person I wanted. You should have found that out beforehand.
I think that's true to a certain extent. I would have concern about that issue. And, you know, I do think that giving birth to a child is a rather unique situation. And though someone may contemplate that they can easily enter into a contract and get their money and give birth to the child and turn the child over to someone else after the birth of the child, I think that it may be very difficult to know how you're going to feel after the birth of that child and whether or not you're going to feel comfortable performing under the terms of the contract. Now, maybe one answer is, well, don't do it. Don't enter into that kind of a contract. But on the other hand, at least in the adoption area, the courts have been enough concerned with the interests of that natural mother to give her the opportunity to change her mind after the birth of the child if she, at that point in time, really doesn't want to surrender the child for adoption.
And
to my way of thinking, maybe this is the same kind of situation in which she is relinquishing custody and terminating her parental rights, and she should have some opportunity beyond the birth of the child to make that choice.
Well, it would appear to me the real question ought to be whether or not the contract was ever allowed him to sign the contract. When you sign a contract, you sign a contract. When you offer a baby up for adoption, you don't sign the baby up for adoption until the final thing. There is a difference.
Now, I see, you know, there's certainly a contractual interest at stake in these cases that wouldn't be true in the adoption case. I certainly agree with you. I guess policy-wise, I might favor outlawing the contract and not allowing that kind of a contract to exist instead of requiring specific performance.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Miller.
It sounds like the answers and to disregard any prospective rights the father might have in this. We're centering around the rights of the mother here, but fathers seem to be out in left field. Is that?
That wasn't right? My intent. I mean, I certainly recognize in this kind of situation you have a natural mother and a natural father, and my way of looking at it would be that you want to focus on the best interests of the child, and if both parents wish to have custody of the child after the birth of the child, then it ought to be a custody kind of proceeding in which you've looked at the best interests of the child and try to figure out how that child should be raised, given the interests of both of the parents. But I agree, I wouldn't ignore the interests of the father any more than I'd ignore the interests of the mother.
Representative Miller.
One further question. Uh-huh. On the best interest question, all other things being close to equal, since you teach in this area, is it still correct to assume that in the huge majority of cases that the young child is going to be awarded to the mother?
That's a good question. The statutes certainly don't say that. The statutes say now that the tender years doctrine is abolished and that we don't have a preference, mother or father. But we did a study in Marion County about 5 years ago looking at custody and how custody came out, and we found that in 80% of the cases, the mother got custody of the child regardless of the age of the child. So I think in reality, most of the time, either by agreement of the two parties or by order of the court, the mother does get custody of the child. But the statutes themselves are neutral in terms of, you know, favoring mother or father. And for whatever reason, though, it seems like mothers get custody more often than fathers.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If I might just follow up on Representative Miller's question. Aren't we delving into areas that have traditionally been problems? I kind of remember first year law school contracts, and I'm sure so does Representative Miller, on the opera singer.
Oh, right. That was, right. That's the
to
other.
Perform, yeah. Specific performance. Can't you speak to that?
Probably not very well.
Can you sing to that?
I might be able to sing to that better than I could speak to that. I would have a concern about the requirement that someone become pregnant and have a child for another, and that, I think, is analogous to the opera singer kind of case that you're talking about from first-year contracts. But on the other hand, once the child's born, I suppose it's a little bit different, and it might be easier to require specific performance, given that there's been a successful pregnancy and the mother's given birth, so you wouldn't have the same kind of problem as you did in the opera singer case. But, I mean, if you had someone paying $10,000 in anticipation of a pregnancy, seems to me you'd have a difficult time enforcing that kind of requirement on the other person. I had one other concern. Well, why don't you go ahead?
Maybe I won't. I'm going to ask committee members to hold their questions because we see all the books you brought and we know you have to get back. Why don't you continue?
I had another concern with reference to the statutes. I see that this proposal, House Bill 3307, would amend 109070 to provide that in that 109070(1) that the presumption of the husband being the father of the child would not apply. The conclusive presumption would not apply if the child was born pursuant to a surrogate mother contract. I think that's one amendment that would definitely have to be in the statutes. Another that I was concerned with concerns the artificial insemination language in our statutes. Our statutes in 109239 at sec 109243 and 247 states that when there is artificial insemination after the birth of the child, the husband of the mother shall be presumed to be the father of the child. Now, in this case, obviously, you wouldn't want to have that kind of presumption operate because you would want the natural father to be considered the father of the child, and so you'd want to make that clear or at least amend, I think, 109239 at sec. The other thing is that our language concerning artificial insemination in our statutes contemplates a situation in which the donor is not known by the mother. In other words, it's an anonymous thing and no one knows who the father of the child is. And of course, this is a little bit different situation in which there's artificial insemination, but you do know who the father of the child is. And I think that should be made clear in the language of the statutes. I have done just brief research in this area. I had a student a couple years ago who wrote an article on surrogate motherhood, and along with her I researched some of the cases that have come down in different jurisdictions, and of course that was before all these various cases that are developing now. But we found that in the couple of cases around the country that had considered a situation involving artificial insemination and parents who really weren't engaging in sexual intercourse and weren't married at the time that the child was born, that the courts were reluctant to enforce the contract or to disallow the rights of the father. These were cases where the mother wished to keep the child and wished to have the father help her give birth to the child, but didn't wish to have the father have any interest in the child following the birth of the child. Courts were reluctant to cut off the rights of the father, and I would think that, you know, in the same sense, one might, if a court were faced with this, one might think that the court would be reluctant to cut off the rights of the mother if the mother, following the birth of the child, wished to be involved in rearing the child and wished to have some custodial relationship with the child. So I think if you want to legalize it, you probably do need some statute. I'm just not sure myself whether this is the best language, but you know, I think you probably do need some language to amend the common law in this area. One other suggestion that I might have would be that if we were to enact a statute similar to this one, we might want to make some kind of window in the law which would give the mother an opportunity, at least for a short time following the birth, to decide whether or not she wished to surrender her child for adoption by the wife of the natural father. And that would make it then more analogous to the adoption statutes. About all I have from this.
Further questions?
Yes, Professor, is the in the adoption statutes where it allows a woman to change her mind afterwards, is the public policy behind that purely the best interest of the child, or is there a recognition that women who have not birthed children may be unaware of the bonding that takes place and make a deal before they understand it?
I think a lot of it has to do with the latter, that the mother has an interest in the child that she may not even understand until after the birth of the child. And at least some of the cases have spoken to the point that it can be coercive to force someone to sign on the dotted line about a child that they haven't even seen yet and that they haven't given birth to yet. And that person ought not to be required to do that until she has seen, she's had an opportunity to see the child and make up her mind after the birth of the child. So it's partially, I guess, the best interest, but it's also, I think, the interest that the mother has in the natural tie to her child.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I'll close the hearing on 3307 and open the hearing on 3197. Does everybody here have 3197, the dash one and the dash two amendments? Should have it either in the handouts for today or already in your files.
Mm-hmm. Do you?
Yeah. Okay. Counsel, if you would describe the dash one, well, let me preface that with, you will recall, committee members, House Bill 3025, Representative Hooley testifying, and the main proponent of 3025 has worked with Representative Bauman on the dash one amendment 3197, along with the proponents. And the dash one amendments, I think, speak to that. Counsel, can you describe what is being accomplished in the dash one amendments?
All right. The dash one amendments, basically just going through them on the sheet that you have before you, subsection one is essentially kind of a quasi-policy statement that wants to emphasize that the best interests of the child must be looked to, and it also brings in explicitly that consideration needs to be given to the physical custodians of children. Going down into sub two, new sub two, in line 19, the inclusion of or wardship, it was also in the original bill as introduced. And the purpose of that was to make it clear that it applies in juvenile court. They deleted in section 2 and also on page 2 in sub 3, they deleted the reference to circuit court. It's now just court because some counties have county courts. So this just kind of cleans it up from that standpoint.
Counsel, may I ask a question? This amendment then would refer to custody and visitation rights of foster parent, step parent, grandparent, or relative by blood or marriage. who has created these emotional ties?
Well, it's not limited to that. That is not intended to be an exclusive list. I mean, any person including but not limited to is the language. So it's sort of any non-parent who's developed these sort of psychological and, you know, emotional ties, whatever.
But at least it's directed at those enough to have them named.
Yes. Yes.
What's the effect of lines 24 and 25 removing that? And how does that fit into the rest of the bill?
Well, essentially, that sentence has been deleted to kind of clean up the bill. There was some confusion as to what precisely that sentence required. And I believe it was Judge Norblad who recommended that be deleted. I mean, the effect is that it does allow intervention in a dissolution situation.
Did it before prohibit intervention in a dissolution?
Well, I think that was some of the ambiguities. I think it was construed, you know, that it did do that, but it was unclear. That was the problem.
What else has this amendment done to perhaps narrow the scope of those who might intervene in conjunction with widening the scope by removing an ambiguity that could be interpreted to have, before this time, prohibited intervention in the dissolution itself?
Well, I don't know if I exactly understand your question. I mean, it makes it clear that the intervention can be at any point. You don't need, before it was hard to